You're listening to The Drop and the Turning, a podcast about music, place, and change, recorded within Treaty 7 territory. My name is Rebecca Bruton. Last spring, I spoke with Lou Shepherd, a Canadian artist working in interdisciplinary audio, performance, and installation-based practice. Of settler ancestry, Shepherd was raised on unceded Mi'kmaq territory in rural Nova Scotia. Shepherd first studied theater at Concordia University in Montreal, and then graduated with a BFA in interdisciplinary studies from the Nova Scotia College of Art and Design. He has also studied English literature and education. Shepherd now lives on the south shore of Nova Scotia, or Mi'kma'ki.
My name is Lou Shepherd, and I am in rural Mi'kma'ki, Nova Scotia, on the south shore, which is sort of an hour and a half outside of Shubuktuk or Halifax, on unceded territory of the Mi'kmaq people. And I am a settler here. I've lived here off and on for my entire life, and recently sort of like pandemic moved to rural Nova Scotia, and now live on like a old farm here. So I'm like, my life has shifted a lot in the last couple of years. It's been really great, but it's also a big learning experience of like how to live, how to kind of make it work in the country. Things happen all the time. Like our cars just recently both broke down at once. So then we were stuck without any cars. You know, the ways that in a more urban environment, you're not dependent on some things in the same way. So that's been a big learning experience, and it has shifted my practice a lot. So I have always worked really responsively to place or to situation, and sort of allowed my practice to be what it needs to be in those responses. Having certain ways that I work, like I often work with music, or I often work with dance or with notations of dance and music. Really in response to an idea or to a place. And so moving out here, my work has really, although I've always had this kind of interest in our like eco crisis and like our current time that we're facing, where we're looking, you know, really intensely facing climate change and climate disaster. I think after moving out here, my work has become much more about the kind of intricacies and interdependencies of living in relation and in an ecology. That's kind of shifted some of my work, I think, it's shifted it, and it's also kind of like affirmed it and made it perhaps a bit more nuanced. So I'm excited about that change. I'm just trying to think like what I perceive my practice to currently be. I'm working on a series of choral pieces because I'm really interested in choirs and thinking about how choirs are these kinds of like, when you sing in a choir, you're experiencing a kind of like beyond your own human limits, out of body experience, where you're kind of connecting with other bodies and singing in unison and breathing in unison with other bodies. So I'm working on three different projects, and each one of them has a choral aspect of it. And as well as sort of performance and like performance somewhere between, I don't want to say theater because that's not really what it is, but it's a kind of like, you know, there's some drag, there's some like acting, there's some like workshop series, like style, like talking. So these kinds of, you know, expanded ideas of what performance can be. Yeah, that's where I'm at right now.
So what did you pay the most attention to today?
Yeah, well, it's spring here. So we are like, and it's, you know, spring here is late. Although I think this spring has actually not been too late, but late compared to maybe a lot of the other parts of the country. But the birds are really in full force right now, and they start singing around 5 in the morning. And I've always been really fascinated with the idea of the dawn chorus and like the way the birds sort of start singing in the morning. So I was listening to that while I have trouble sleeping. So I was having trouble sleeping this morning, and I was listening to that and then headed out into the forest for a walk this morning. And I was listening to the birds, and there's it's always interesting to be like, oh, who's here today? Like, who's really loud today? And there's this call that I'm not familiar with, but I'm sure it's like, I'm sure I am familiar with it. I just couldn't place whose call it was. So that was the thing that was drawing my attention the most, I think, this morning. I really do, when I'm paying attention, like, I do think that I operate a lot through my ears, like I'm really listening. Even though I don't know why it is, but that's how I kind of tune into things, but that's sort of where my attention sort of focuses. So, yeah.
So in relation to being out in the forest, can you describe one of the earliest moments in your life when you remember feeling connected to a non-human or more than human natural space?
Hmm. Yeah, it's funny to be like earliest moments, because I was raised in a rural environment, and I was I was raised with my folks really excited and interested in like the woods and in being outside. I spent a lot of time alone in the woods when I was a kid, because I'm not an only child, but my sister is a bit older than me. So as I was growing up, like, I was sort of spending a lot of time like reading or like out in the woods, kind of like walking around. And I had a lot of, I don't know. I would say I was sort of like I had certain things that I always checked on every day. So I'd like do these little rounds in the forest that my parents lived on. But I think, so I don't know if it's easy to pinpoint a particular moment, because I think I've always been really in relation, like really understood myself in relation to, the natural world. I think I've actually been troubling that relationship more and more. Like, as I think when I was growing up, I really felt like I was, really of this place. And so I have Scottish ancestry and this place is called Nova Scotia. And so I sort of had this like sense of deep connectedness to this land. And, I think I drew a lot of a sense of belonging and a sense of place from that. And since learning that Nova Scotia, of course, has another name, or many other names, but one of them being Mi'kma'ki, and knowing the history of colonization here a bit, and learning a bit more about how this land was in fact stolen, and that is stolen by my ancestors, has made me really think about how it is that we construct these relationships between our bodies and the landscape, and like how it is that we start to think about ourselves in relation to place. So I think I think it's kind of been like a journey of like really having that deeply inside myself when I was younger, and then needing to really question that, and question the kind of languages and discourses that I have to relate to place in the ways that they've privileged like my place here. So like, you know, calling this place Nova Scotia privileges like my Scottish ancestry here, but when I call it Mi'kma'ki, it like privilege it positions me as a guest or as a settler, as an uninvited guest here. So I've been really thinking about those relationships and thinking about the ways that I feel like I am kind of part of this place. And then recently I own land here, 12 acres. And so, you know, of owning stolen land is like a complicated thing, and feeling like this sense of stewardship, but then a sense of criticality around that as well, has been complicated. And then recently I realized, like, I was talking to somebody about wetlands and about like the ways that we have like quite a bit of swamp area in our property. And I was talking to people about like this way that wetlands, the bacteria in them actually like is really healing. So if you're like, if you have like a cut on you, you can apparently like take like plants from a wetland and put it on your cut, and it will like help you heal the cut, which I was really interested in. And that just made me start to think about, instead of having this relationship where I was like, oh, this is like mine, or this is like my place, I started thinking about it as like, this is the place that I love and that I'm like in relationship with in that way, that I like kind of have this like that I am like in service to it. And so that's been like a kind of there and back of those ideas of like what it means to be, I guess, like outside of a human-centered body.
Yeah.
Now, earlier on, right when we started talking, you mentioned that you're excited about choral music and how we become sort of bigger than our own bodies when we're singing in a choir. Now, one of the places my mind immediately went to was my own troubled relationships to scores. And often when I think of choral music, I particularly think of a score and a choir conductor and sort of the culture of choirs, some of which I think is really about community and connection. But as is the case with all, I think, all like traditional Western notation contexts, there can also be a lot of elitism built into that. And so one of the questions I had prepared beforehand was, what are some of the tools and techniques you work with to invite agency from others? And then how do you then perceive your own agency with a work? Yeah. So I'm so curious about how you're navigating writing for groups of human bodies, or even if you think of it as writing for or perhaps facilitating a connection of some sort. I would love if you could talk about that.
Yeah, it's such a big question. And there's so many different ways that I've thought about it. And the choir, like working with choirs is relatively new for me. And it's kind of like shifting. I mean, it is another branch of this, but I think one of the things, so when I started out working with notations, I don't think I had the kind of like experience to recognize the kind of baggages and like, I guess the kind of like histories of notation systems, and that those baggages and histories are the same as other languages, you know, that like, that these are like ways of thinking, and that they're like kind of ontologies within themselves, and that when we work within a certain notation system, we're working as well with the like the kind of histories of that notation system. And if that notation system comes from like a Eurocentric history, then it carries like all of that like all of that, for better or for worse. And I didn't really, I think, you know, I knew that about language, but I think I needed to kind of work through some of that stuff in notation systems before I could really feel that. So my early work, I started working with, score, like staffs and notes on a staff, and like kind of what I knew as how to read music and like how music was recorded. And I also started to work with dance notation, like Laban notation, which is a notation that dancers, this Rudolf Laban developed to work with ballet dancers in particular, which has a super fascinating history and has been used as well to like assess the movements of workers in factories, and it's also used to assess like people on autism spectrum. So it's just like such a interesting history of this notation system, but it's like got a lot. I mean it actually, when you're looking at the ways that it notates dance and body movement, it's notating it within a very like a very constrained and very like ballet sort of centric way. So it's like really looking at movements that are very definitive and not like movements that might flow over time. That being said, I think, you know, people can work with it how they work with it, but all of that to say, confronting that in my work, like through two pieces in particular, there's a piece that I made early on called Requiem for the Antarctic Coast, which was like scoring the Antarctic coastline in like on a musical staff. And then a strong desire, which was scoring the shape, like the negative space, to a particular piece of text with Laban notation. And I can get into both of those works later, but all of that to say, you know, like I worked with them and I had to kind of like sit with them. And then as I watched, like I brought performers in to kind of play those, and ask them to perform them, and recognize that I was working counter to how I was actually, what I was trying to do. Cause what I was really trying to do was deconstruct the languages that we have to talk about or to kind of like experience certain things, or identify certain things. And instead I was like stuck between these like sort of static language systems, whether it was notation or English or notation or like mapping, you know. And so from there, I started to research more about graphic scores and try to look at the ways that I might score things more based on experience, like to like kind of score an experience or to score a kind of like location or place in my work, rather than to score a series of actions to happen within that place. And I also started to look at ways that I could use languages and kind of play with those languages and break them apart to use them as scores. So the first thing that I started doing in that was I started working with sonograms, which are like sound images. And that was in like working with birdsong and wanting to score this kind of idea of what I wanted to score the experience of like losing birdsong in the environment, knowing how many birds were being lost, like kind of annually, and also thinking about the way birds are a kind of indicator of environmental health or like specific like ecological health. And so I was looking at spectrograms that are like pictures of bird songs, and I took them and started reading those spectrograms as graphic scores as a way of kind of like subverting the scientific imperialism of them. And then from there, I got less and less interested in the idea less attached to the idea that a certain kind of sound would come out of a certain score, and more interested in the idea that I could create the conditions of time and space within the scores, that then to see what will happen within those times and spaces. So that's where I think I really started to kind of ask for a lot more performer agency in the work, and really thinking about how to push this idea of not just, because I think, you know, like not just like sort of improvisation, but actually like asking performers to come into this space of like conversation with me, and then to like play within that conversation. And so this, and that has like shifted some of my work away from being performed as music, although a lot of my work still can kind of be performed as music, or musicians or people who like kind of make sounds are often like, you know, like that is really part of how people interact with my work and how I'm thinking about my work. But more, I think it's opened it up in terms of wanting to bring people into a kind of space where actions can happen rather than like the idea of witnessing a series of actions. So maybe to like make that a little more clear, a recent score that I made was called Crepuscular Rhythms, and it was about the time of dawn and dusk. And I was thinking about dawn and dusk as these kind of queer times of day, and wanting to capture the light. I think about the way that light exposes at those times of day. And so I made a score that notated the angles of dawn and dusk, and like the angles of the sun below the horizon, that like kind of move the sun into this time of dawn or dusk. And sort of created this score that like tried to hold something of that time and place of dawn and dusk, and then brought musicians in to interact with it. And the way that we played the score was actually just to like have a conversation about queer safety and queer bodies and queer exposure, and this kind of like magical times of day, and how it feels to be sort of like counter a sort of more heteronormative time, like, and so this sort of like queer temporality and all of these things, and then those musicians work together to bring a piece out of that conversation. So yeah, that's sort of like the first part of that question. And then the second, you know, now I'm working with choirs, and of course, like, I started working with choirs and thinking like, okay, I have this sort of like this idea of how to kind of bring voices in relation to each other, and then recognizing that actually I do need to give a lot more direction to a group of people who are singing together, because that is part of how the magic of a choir works, right? Is that like you sing in unison together. And, you know, I think one of the things that I've learned in the experiments that I've done is like that it's actually, you know, it's not giving people direction that takes agency from them. I think it's like it actually can add agency to it, you know, can like provide agency to a performer to be like to give clear, strong direction. And I think I found my voice with that a bit more. Like, I think I really took some time to be like, oh, I don't know. You decide, like, you do what you want. I like, oh, like, I just want you to kind of like express yourself. And the truth is, when you're performing, in my experience of performing, is that like having clear, strong leadership within that can really allow for your own performance, like your own practice as a performer, to kind of shine and to come out. And so that's been part of my understanding, like having some like epic fails of like working with choirs and being like, ooh, like I just haven't given you enough to work with. And then everyone just sort of feels like deflated, because it's like, you know, we're trying our best, but not having enough to kind of actually cohese around. And so I think that's been a way that I've shifted to thinking about how to work with groups of performers and choirs in that way. And like, and from like this place of, you know, wanting to provide a lot of being kind of like working out what it means to give direction and what it means to provide agents, or like to like encourage agency. And so I think I've now come to this understanding of like how I can work with people and really value their performance, and also really value my role as in a leadership role within, in relation to those performances. And that, you know, like always, of course, also with like conversation and like making sure that people have what they need and that their, you know, their ideas are heard within that. But, you know, like also not shying away from the idea that we can like lead people in things, and that we can like that is part of the experience of coming together in performance. So yeah, I don't know, that's a bit of a long answer, but it's been a real huge learning process in my practice.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I think I was drawn to this idea that without sensing a clear leadership from you, that can almost be a bit unmooring for a performer. And I think part of the beauty of you coming in and offering them a structure and then guiding them in it is that then a performer might create something that they never would have thought of themselves. And then you can also respond to that. So then you sort of become bigger than what you maybe initially planned. And that's not an unethical relationship. That's a fascinating relationship that I think performers are craving as well.
Well, I think, you know, and it didn't come without some bumps in the road, but it's like interesting when you say like bigger than me, and it's like, you know, like there is this sort of like, there is a sort of funny thing around like my name on a piece of work that people are performing and are contributing to in that way. And I have really thought about how to like center performers in the work that I do, and like to make sure that that the value, like the performances are valued, and that the improvisation within that is valued. And but, you know, it is bigger than me. It's the role, like understanding my role in that has meant that I've been able to kind of take that leadership role, but then also like recognizing that it's not like my egocentric moment. It's like me stepping up and saying, this is, you know, we're all here, and like you're willing to participate in this with me, and this is the idea that like I'm kind of wanting to talk about, and like finding ways to invite people into that and then support them within that. And so, yeah, it is like, but I also, you know, like I come from a teaching background, and I think that it is like, you know, my work is really informed by that. You know, like I really do think a lot about how to support people, you know, like, and how to kind of guide people and support people in like all of my work. So yeah, I think that's like a big part of it. And I think there was like something else that you said that I just wanted to respond to, this idea of, you know, a performer, how a performer works, and having worked with a bunch of dancers over a few, you know, the past few years, and especially with dancers, I think, but with musicians as well, I think, you know, like watching the ways that that bodies, like the, you know, like, well, I guess the experience that I had that it really stuck home for me was with dancers. And so that's why I'm sort of thinking of dancers, but it totally does happen with musicians. But I think like this idea of watching these two dancers that I was working with in particular, and recognizing that their practice was happening through the performance that they were giving, like that was their practice, is like this performance. And then recognizing like that, that they were engaged in like the making of their practice, and in the like kind of stuff of their practice through the performance of this score that I was giving them. And it was like, oh right, like this is not like me being like, move this way, do this, do that. This is me being like participating with them in their practice, and in my own, and them participating in my practice. And like it just like it made me understand that relationship in such a different way.
There's one phrase that you mentioned earlier that I wanted to ask you more about. It was the term scientific imperialism, when you were talking about spectrograms and the mapping of the coastline. And so I would love to hear what it means to you to be attaching the word imperialism with the notion of science.
I mean, and I don't want to be, because I think there's this idea that like art is, well, okay, so to sort of take it back, you know, like recognizing that this there's this sort of idea that art might be counter science or against science, you know, that like art looks to the places that science can't describe, something like that. And I really don't believe that at all. I think that science and art are like very similar practices, you know, like it is so much of what both scientists and artists do is about observation and is about like translation and about intersecting with phenomena and trying to give like language and structure to phenomena. And I think like all of that is like that is like so much part of what my practice is about, and so much of what I see scientists doing, and when I get to talk to scientists, like that's so much of where we meet. But I think there's this idea that data is without like that data is not, I guess like what I mean is like I think we often think about like the idea of like scientific data or data of any kind as being completely objective, you know, that like that it is like in fact not even a language, it is just kind of fact. And the thing is that like all of the ways that we understand the world through data are also mediated through like the lens of data itself, like that you know, data relies on a certain set of like ways of thinking about the world. So much of the way that data operates is around like even just like thinking on a Cartesian plane of like X and Y axis, you know, like thinking about like heights and frequencies rather than like, you know, like all of that is like a language, and all of that can be deconstructed. And I think that is what excites me about thinking about how to kind of like push against that idea that there is fact in the world, and recognize that whenever we're interpreting experience or whenever we're interpreting phenomena, we're really like we're doing it through a lens or like through a language. And yeah, so I guess pushing against that idea that there is like that, you know, like a map is fact, and saying like a map is a construction, it's a way of looking at something, and it's a tool of you know, like mapping is like a real tool of like colonizers to like lay claim to space. A spectrogram, you know, is this sort of interesting, like spectrograms are really amazing, like, and biologists will use them to like study shifts in populations of birds. And like if you look at spectrograms and you recognize that like you can see bird calls changing, and that's ways to kind of indicate that there's like massive changes in the environment because the birds are reacting to those changes through the calls. And but then of course also like spectrograms are written as a series of rhythms and frequencies, and those rhythms and frequencies are like those are ways of quantifying sound that are constructed, you know, like that isn't just like that's not just how sound exists, like it's not like that's actually what sound looks like. So I think like that's kind of where I want to push, and that's the kind of what I talk about, you know, the reason to use the word imperialism is because I think there's this way that this kind of like, you know, I don't need like there's this way in which we say that something is fact, and that means that we can't question the way that it's constructed. And that doesn't mean that I don't believe in science at all, but I think I believe even more in it. And also recognize like in the same ways that like all languages are lenses, you know, this is also a lens. So yeah.
I had a realization for myself as you were speaking of of how imperialism is often is like I was thinking like if someone I know who's an engineer were hearing this interview, then that term imperialism is a system of measurement. But when I hear imperialism, I think about colonization.
Well, yeah, and I always get the words empirical and imperial messed up. And
oh, right.
I enjoy using the word imperial because I am like, yeah, but this is also about dominance of the landscape. And so, Yeah. So I use those two terms with a lot more poetic license than maybe is common.
Something that you touched on was how you have these ideas of dawn and dusk as queer times of day. I'm very curious about that. And can you describe more of what you mean by that?
Well, I think, yeah, like, so that project's been ongoing in my practice for a long time. It started from a conversation about this idea that dawn and dusk could be kind of considered non-binary times, or like these like in-between liminal spaces or queer spaces. And particularly in reference to safety, you know, like if non-normative bodies are moving through environments, like, you know, particularly urban environments, then dawn and dusk provide a kind of cover for moving around the city rather than, say, like the bright light of day or the like total darkness of night. And so, you know, I was like talking, you know, like this kind of resonated for me when we were having this conversation. I was having this conversation with this person and I was like, you know, it's true. Like in my most anxious moments, I would not want to be out in like full sun. Like I would want to be out at these sort of like half times of half light, or like these sort of like moments. But I think, and so I originally, like I wrote this crepuscular rhythm score, crepuscular meaning like active at dawn and dusk. And I worked with musicians to create a sound piece in relation to it. But then also I took 18 t-shirts and I dipped them in like a light exposure fluid, cyanotype fluid. So they would basically like show how exposed to light they were, and really like, so I almost made them like photosensitive. And then I wore those t-shirts on a series of walks through the city I was living in, to expose them at these kind of very precise moments of dawn and dusk. And now here's the thing about dawn and dusk that's like really extra poetic, is that we don't just have dawn and dusk, but we actually, it's broken down into three separate parts of dawn and dusk. So we have astronomical dawn, and then nautical dawn, and then civil dawn. And these are like three different points of light that fill the sky until the sun fully comes over the horizon. And then as we move into dusk, we have civil dusk, nautical dusk, and astronomical dusk. And so I was really thinking about this idea of these kinds of like focusing and releasing, and this sort of movement through this time, and the way that, like, you know, it had been like poetically described, but as, you know, like, you know, as, well, now we're in nautical dusk, or now we're moving into astronomical dusk. And so I was just taken with the magic of those moments. And so, like, you know, working through the kind of idea of safety and the kind of idea of cover and like exposure, and like specifically related to queerness. And then as I kept thinking about that idea, I really started to understand that what I was attracted to was this idea of like a kind of queer cosmology, or like of a way of like understanding the relationships of like the sun and moon and stars and planets, like of like queering that understanding, or like of sort of trying to kind of think about different ways of experiencing that temporalities. And so I have been really thinking about these times of dawn and dusk, and holding them as like these sorts of like moments of possibility, for like, yeah, like for all kinds of things. But of course, like I made that piece and then I realized that I had made Dawn Chorus and Evensong, which is a piece that notates bird songs at dawn and dusk. And so like, I've always sort of been like occupied, like really like occupied with this idea of dawn and dusk. And so, yeah. And so more recently I was, you know, like since sort of leaving a city and moving out to the country and thinking like, well, now what does it mean to interact with these times of day when it's no longer about a kind of like exposure or like protective cover, but there is still this kind of idea of like queerness within these moments of day. And so I've been really like kind of trying to figure out or like think about like what it means to kind of like sit in the queerness of those moments. So yeah.
It almost sounds like there's an aspect of the liberatory nature of now being in a rural space and not requiring that form of cover, like the form of what might be dangerous to you has changed. But I think there's a tendency within queer community to talk about rural spaces as not being safe for queers. So that I was just curious, this isn't a fully formed question yet, but I thought it was powerful what you said about dawn and dusk, your ideas around those as queer times of day being formed from a sense of cover being needed, but then being in a more isolated rural space, that need becomes less. So then what do those spaces now mean in their ongoing queerness?
Yeah, I mean, it's been interesting, and like just to reflect on what you're saying about like rural areas, and like this part of what I've really been trying to figure out is like, why is it that we think that queerness doesn't belong in a rural environment? Like, why really? Like, you know, and of course there's this idea that we like, you know, like when I was like young and growing up in the rural environment, I didn't have community I couldn't find the community that I was like really craving, or there just wasn't like the kind of critical mass of people around me that I found when I went to Toronto or to Montreal, right? Where I was like, oh, actually, like, you know, this is a way that I can start to understand myself and kind of like find myself in relation to other people, to understand my queerness. But you know, like why do we think that queerness doesn't belong in the countryside? And I think like, as I was like recently really interrogating that idea, you know, because I think like I have this sort of like, you like sense of, I don't know, like sense of like humor about being like, here I am, like this like total weirdo out in the country, and my like 80-year-old neighbors are like, you know, don't quite know what to make of me, but also are totally accepting and loving to me. And like, how, like, what are these kind of like funny relationships, and ways that like I'm kind of figuring out how to exist here. But then, you know, like, so thinking of this idea of like why queerness doesn't belong in nature or like in a rural environment. And it's like really recognizing like part of how, like, and I mean, you know, like our rhetoric around like the kind of like homophobia that I grew up with is different than the homophobia that exists now, which doesn't mean, but these things are still really present. But I know that like when I was growing up, it was this idea that queerness was unnatural, or like it was a sin against nature. And it's like, it's like against God, or like against, like, you know, not that, this was not the case in my family. You know, I wasn't raised like religious, but like I was raised in a fairly conservative area. And it's like this idea that queerness just like, it goes against nature, was really like drilled into me. And, you know, so part of what I've been thinking about with this idea of like claiming dawn and dusk as these kinds of queer moments of the day where like, they are not day, they are not night. Also claiming the space, like the sort of intertidal zone, saying like, this isn't, you know, this is like, this shows us how something can not be one or the other, but also can be like, can show us how to kind of like embrace the complexities of queerness, you know, where like something is water and then it is sand and then it is water and then it is sand, you know, and that like, that these spaces give us a place to kind of think about the ways that nature is actually like very queer in its like working, and like the ways that like ecological and relationships and the interdependencies and symbioses like, you know, they don't fit into the heteronormative framework that has kind of been placed on them. And so that's been really what I've been, you know, like when I think about like my new work or sort of what I'm working on right now, I talk a lot about this idea of like queer ecology, not to say necessarily even that, like, you know, animals are gay, which like some animals are, but more to say like, where are the places that we can push against boundaries and binaries in the ways that we think about our relationships within nature, and like start to see how queerness can start to break those down so that we can sort of live with more awareness around those interdependencies and reciprocal relationships. So that's, yeah, that's been kind of like how it's like exploded out into my practice. But yeah, this idea of like being against nature, queerness being against nature, is like really interesting to push back against. So
we are close, but never quite together. In the space between us, we sometimes meet.
Moving sort of towards the close of this conversation, I saw on your website that you were recently in residence at a rural, at the King's Playhouse in Georgetown, PEI, and that it was part of a project called Radiant Rural Halls, which I think is a beautiful title and so evocative. And so I'm curious about what you ended up working on in that project and where you are now coming out of it.
Yeah, actually, I mean, so a lot of that thinking, like I was kind of solidifying while I was in PEI. Okay, so to start, this project is so beautiful. And I have like asked This Town Is Small, This Town Is Small is the artist run center in sort of operates like in multiple sites around Prince Edward Island. And they had this really beautiful idea of animating rural community space, like hall spaces, as spaces for contemporary art practice. And I fell in love with that idea. And then asked them, like, I was like, can I just like encourage other people to do this? And they were like, yes. So it's a really beautiful idea of like bringing artists like in, I don't know if, I mean, I think we all have like seen these like rural community centers or halls. We have one down the street from our house. And it's like this kind of amazing building that like is in like various states of repair. And the idea of like, you know, it being a center for community action, you know, like it's like a place where people might have community suppers or parties or like celebrations in the community. And as well as like kind of, you know, whatever strange things happen there, the farmers market happens at the one down the street from our house. But then the idea that they could also be spaces where contemporary art practice happens in whatever ways that it does, just got me so excited. Cause I think, you know, sometimes with my work, like I live in this community, but I work elsewhere, or my work is sort of like seen elsewhere. And even like my work is related so intensely to this place, but then my work is seen elsewhere, I can share it elsewhere. So I think, I was able to go to King's Playhouse, which is like a much more established and like thriving rural hall. It's like actually a whole theater and has like a big multi-purpose room. I asked to be in residence there for a week to kind of think through this idea of like, what does it mean to be queer in a rural environment? And like, what is it like, how do we start to recognize queerness in our rural, in our sort of experiences of the rural. And so that's what I was thinking about. And like all of that thinking that I was just talking about around, you know, what does it mean when you say queerness is against nature, and like, how can we find queerness in nature, is all like sort of things that I was thinking about there. And so I was working specifically on a series of scores, and they were not scores for playing, they weren't like music scores or even performance scores. This is like a kind of shift in my work to like scores for attention. And so I wanted to offer them as these like ways of attending to queerness in this space. And so like to perform these scores, really, it was like I explained it to people saying like, you can perform this by actually just like attending to this space in the environment. And so part of it was like looking at the migration of sand dunes and PEI, and this like kind of idea of like these unfixed and roving geological phenomena in PEI, because sand dunes on, basically PEI is like eroding really quickly. It's a sandbar. And then the sand dunes will move from, like they'll kind of like move from place to place through like the wind and the currents, which is like so fascinating to me, because they're like these kind of huge, incredible fixtures in the landscape, but then they like are also always shifting. As well as like thinking about I was really struck by this term that I uncovered from geology. I've been really like digging into like some geological research lately, but I was struck by this term rhythmite, and a rhythmite is the like imprint of action on land, like the kind of like rhythmic imprint of water, or like of, I think it's mostly water on stone or on land as it's recorded in stone. And so, you know, you can think of it like when you go to the lake, like shore of a lake, or like to the shore of like the ocean, and you see those ridges that the water has created in the sand, those are rhythmites. So it's like, so I called all of this suite of scores rhythmites, you know, this way of thinking about action and the impression of action. And there was like five of them, and they were like, probably not like, they were like, I would say not super well formed after just the week of working, but what I was really hoping for was like insight into how I might start working like in the future. And so like, I think this idea of like finding, like responding to place through score is like becoming even like more and more present in my work. But the thing I wanted to mention is like from that work, I've been collaborating with this artist, the musician Emily Kennedy in Fredericton. And Emily and I were talking about these scores in PEI and how to kind of like bring, like whether we would like perform these or like how we would kind of like move through this. And now we're working on a piece that actually considers the floodplain of the Willistiqua River, and treating that floodplain as a kind of score, and imagining like sound within that space. So that's kind of like where that work is like happening. But yeah, I'm really interested in the idea that we might be able to relate, like that as a contemporary artist, I can also be working and relating to my community, and sharing my work with my community, like my sort of rural community, and trying to figure out ways to do that. So yeah, that was that project.
You've been listening to The Drop and the Turning. Each of the musical excerpts you heard in today's episode were from Lou Shepherd's exhibition, Rites of Passage, at the Art Gallery of York University in 2022. Rites of Passage is comprised of five scores based on the interactions between rivers and the city in Toronto. This served as the chorus for a three-act play that followed a drag performer / plant species through Toronto's riparian zones. The scores were interpreted and directed by Pamela Hart and sung by eight voices: Kira Daube, Ren Tian, Seamus Gallagher, Arjun Lal, Hayla Cooper, Lou Campbell, Lou Shepherd, and Pamela Hart.